Hi and hello Watch fans, and welcome to another edition of The Real Time Show. Today we are back in the studio, all three of us, David, Alon and me, to discuss David's recent article about the downturn of the watchmaking industry. Now once again we find ourselves in a position where perhaps we think we don't have all that much to say on the topic because we're all pretty much in agreement with what David wrote. But let's start the conversation and see where we go. As ever, David, let's turn it over to you. If you can give us a summary, please, of what it was you wanted to lay down for our audience.
All right, Rob, thank you very much for that introduction. It's always just a huge pleasure to be here talking watches with you two. And today I'm just going to go straight into it and not call you out, Rob, but maybe push you a little bit because all three of us may be in agreement, but I think that what we're going to talk about today actually puts us quite a bit a ways from what I've seen within kind of the watch press generally most recently. And so for those who haven't listened to the article, please do. It's about 11 minutes long, so it's not a very huge commitment. But essentially, I am making the case that we're not just seeing a pullback in the hot watches. I mean, I'm sure everyone's heard of stories of Daytona's dropping in price, Royal Oaks, etc. I think we're going to be in a full-on, I guess, recession could be the word. And I base this on nothing that's particularly scientific. And I guess just let me explain that. I don't know that I'm necessarily very good at one thing, but one skill I do try and develop is just trying to understand what are some factors that contribute to anything. I mean, you know, the watch industry in this case, or in my job, it might be something else, but just trying to understand what is it that affects something else? Because if I can understand those underlying factors, I can make some inferences about what might be happening down the pipeline. And even more so when you have the benefit of hindsight. And that's something else I mentioned was this is obviously not the first instance of a recession the industry has gone through. So when you start to identify some of those underlying factors, you break it down with regards to supply and demand, and then you look at the past recession we've been through, my hypothesis is that the industry is going to be hurting. Certainly, maybe not now, but end of the year 2024 and going into 2025, I think we're going to see some pain start to develop. So you've both listened to the article. Rob, Alon, what were your thoughts when you first heard it?
I don't always agree with you, maybe more often not than I do, but your title said it all. What comes up or what goes up must come down. So everybody remembers the seven fat years and the seven meager years. So it's a parabolic evolution. So I agree with you 100%. And things are cooling down because yesterday I spoke to a hardcore Swiss watchmaking industry insider. And many, many watch factories are now back at 80%. So they ask their staff to work 20% less. So things are cooling down hardcore. Rob, what do you think?
I think we're definitely seeing a collapse in confidence in the market. I'm interested in digging into the whys. Certainly, as David said, if we're able to identify a few of those, that'll be crucial information for our listeners. But one thing that makes me pause on perhaps the pessimism that might be associated with such a downturn is the fact that this is probably what the watch industry needed for several reasons, actually. Firstly, we've seen brands being not just stretched to capacity, but blown apart because they've overextended themselves for the last couple of years. How many major brands have got waiting lists for their preferential models? How many major brands, and when I say major, mostly the independents probably are struggling with the supply chain. How many brands have been forced to effectively stop selling and start making more than they've ever been able to before to meet this incredible demand? Now, obviously, this scarcity, and we're talking about true scarcity for once, has motivated over the past couple of years an explosion in secondary market prices, which got to the point of absolute ridiculousness and left a sour taste in the mouths of many, I would say, true watch fans and avid collectors and even hobbyists that wanted to get involved in the hobby but found themselves priced out of it because of this rush for acquisition. So from a consumer perspective, this is really a good thing, I would guess. The only drawback I can see from a consumer perspective is if the investments made by many brands who are struggling to meet the demand that they experienced over the last couple of years now result in them being overextended and sitting on stock that nobody wants anymore, because so many of those orders must have been made by people who were just trying to capitalize on this incredible desire for these pieces and the prices that were going through the roof. They could find themselves in a situation where they might be facing immediate extinction, and not just bankruptcy, but on the hook for a hell of a lot of money. And the other thing that I'd like to touch upon is the watchmakers, what it means for them. Any company you go to is pretty much always on the lookout for good watchmakers. It's interesting to hear that workforces are being reduced or put on temporary leave in some cases, Alon, because there's just not the work to be done. I'd like to know from your insider, if possible, which departments are suffering in this way the most. Is it the watchmaking departments themselves, or is it more like sales, communication, or events, or so on and so forth? So let's maybe try and answer that question first. Alon, do you know which departments are really being not laid off, but put on pause?
So he was talking about the T3, T4, so let's say assembly, right? So getting to finished products, because the moment these are finished, they're activated on the balance sheet, especially for the big groups, that becomes a big issue for the CFO, right? So he was talking mostly about that, so on the manufacturing side of things. And to rebuttal on what you said, I agree with you 100%. It is a good thing because, as David indicated in his article and his article, the meteoric rise in demand of watches was caused during COVID, A, because of the huge surplus of savings that didn't go to travel, restaurants, or whatever, because everybody is sitting at home. But a second big reason was that a lot of people entered the luxury watch game because watches suddenly were tagged as a commodity. And we've discussed this also in length during previous episodes, of which I'm not a fan of, and I believe you two are neither. So you see that obviously consumer behavior during a lockdown is totally different than normal situations. So you'll see less money flowing to watches after lockdowns. And I believe that now the rather steep decline in the delta between, let's say, price of a retail recommended price and the market prices is coming down. It's still often on the popular models higher. So there's more demand than supply, meaning people are willing to pay more for a particular watch than that it costs as RRP. And I still see that in our boutiques. So when people talk about a loss, and that's also a big discussion, loss is when you actually have executed on a deal, right? On paper, you don't gain or lose anything unless you're taxed for it. But if we take the American model of capital gains, you only pay taxes when you actually make a profit. So when people are very dramatic and, I lost a lot of money on my Rolex on my wrist, you didn't lose anything. You're enjoying it every day. So every day is a win, in my humble opinion. But that's a total different discussion. So these are the two biggest reasons I would point out. And then maybe later on we can continue, because David ends his article on a very, very important note that it seems, and probably he's very much right so, that there are more and more novelty launches. So brands put out a lot of watches, new ones. And we see new players, a lot of new brands. You indicated micro brands, but that's a discussion for another time. What and who is a micro brand and what isn't?
Yeah, I agree. I don't like the watches being viewed as investment assets, shall we say, investment instruments, whatever you want to call them. That was bad for the collector community in general from a purity perspective, I would say. But was it so bad from a secondary market activity perspective? Because one of the things about watches is that although I don't agree that you should look at them as investments and say, am I going to make money on this? And if the answer is no, then you're not going to buy it because I see them as emotional investments and one should never spend more than they can afford to lose on a watch. That's just my personal policy. I think one that you both share personally as well. But that excitement in the secondary market was also exciting for people who had watches, who had acquired them at a time when they weren't inflated to such ridiculous levels and were either able to sell them and buy niche products that they, as lovers of watchmaking, had been interested in, or to move over to another product and perhaps see that also climb in value after they bought it. Now, of course, if the secondary market is collapsing and watches are regularly trading below their retail price, which is how it should be, really, is it a bad thing or a good thing? Because I think it sort of clears out a lot of people from the industry that maybe shouldn't have been there. And that's a harsh thing to say, but I think everybody knows what I mean when I say that. People who aren't really as interested in the craft of watchmaking as they are in turning a quick profit. And it makes those pieces all the more accessible, and it means that you can still trade existing watches for stuff of like even-ish value. So a watch may not be an investment asset, but it is a tradable commodity because it has appeal to other people in the industry. So are we going to see much more, like a maybe a higher volume of activity in the secondary market, just operating at a lower price point and price points below retail values that is good for the hobby? But if that is the case, does it therefore make it harder for these new brands? And let's talk about that, whether they're micro brands or small independents, let's just call them startup brands entering the market, to appear valuable. Because let's take an example, and then I'll kick it over to David for his opinion on this, and then back to you, Alon. Let's take Space One, established by our good friend Guillaume Lede. Obviously, there was a whole saga around the launch of that project originally on Kickstarter under a different name, Argon Watches. You can go check out the articles and the episodes that we did about this project because there was a lot to chop up there. Let's take that as a model. So that was a really good value, exciting, different, creative project priced around 1,500 francs per piece, although there were price breaks if you bought multiple pieces. So when the secondary market was crazily inflated and when new models were unavailable from more established brands, something like that had a great deal of power because it was like a way to get something cool and interesting on your wrist at not a great deal of money in comparison to what you'd have to pay to pick up something from a longer tenured brand. Now, however, these newer, more creative products that are coming into the industry at very fair prices for what they are in the grand scheme of things have to contend with the brand power of watches that are now more affordable than they were 2 years ago. So this influx of new brands, we can understand where it came from because all of these guys were probably thinking, wow, watchmaking is booming. There's money to be made if we do something a little bit off the beaten track at a good price. Now their whole concept has surely been shifted somewhat and it's certainly been destabilized by this drop in confidence in the secondary market. David, what do you think about that in the context of your last point?
Oh, man, so much to say based on what you both just set forth. You know, I don't want to give too many spoilers away for the second part because there is a second part to this article where I very humbly, as always, suggest what I would do if I were CEO of a watch company. I think, Rob, what you're getting at is that it's not possible, I don't think, or it will not be possible based on the thoughts I put forward in the article, to just put something out there and assume you're going to sell it. Now, that was never the case if you were a small brand relative to like a Rolex or an Audemars Piguet, but I think it's going to be even harder to do so. Having said that, what it really comes down to is that I'm not saying the watch industry is going to disappear. I do think it is going to contract very heavily, and we can talk about what happened during the last downturn in the mid-2010s a little farther along in this episode. But I do think that is coming, but that does not mean that you cannot sell watches. I think what it's going to come down to is that because the flippers and some of the dealers are clearing out, it's going to fall back on the brands to really think about what it is they're releasing. So in other words, this is the product I'm designing. Who should I sell it to? Or this is who I'd like to sell to. What product should I design? And in the case of Space One, you know, clearly it was an enthusiast crowd. someone who might be familiar with like de Bethune's design language or some brand similar to that. And so there was a very identified slice of people. And I think that if companies continue to do that or start doing that, they will find success. I think the trouble that I'm anticipating is the overhang. So if you were one of those companies that started when things were fantastic and you just had model after model after model coming out and you haven't cleared those out, that could cause a problem for you when you try to introduce new models into a potentially smaller market of receptive people.
Good point, David. That being said, are we happy with that big influx of the Space Ones of this world, meaning these little new popping up brands that fill niches we maybe didn't know we had or needed? And, or are you saying it's too much?
Excellent question. You know, I think that the ability to create today in 2024 is a double-edged sword. So in other words, it is very, very, very easy, relatively speaking again, to put something out into the market, whether that be an idea or a watch in this particular case. The maybe negative flip side is that it's not always great. And so you end up kind of flooding the channels with stuff that is not so fantastic. And then it makes it even harder for the end consumer to kind of sift through it and make a decision. Having said that, I think that it is fantastic having all of this choice, basically. Where I think it becomes problematic, and this is really what I was thinking about when I was writing the article, because clearly, you know, all of the other watch publications have been talking about the high-end stuff. We're now sort of starting to discuss the really smaller-end stuff. I'm kind of thinking of the traditional, not middle-market brands, but the ones that everyone thinks of, Tudor, Breitling, Omega, the likes of those. And what I'm most concerned about, I think, if you can call it that, is that we are going to see something like what happened in 2010. So you have just excess stock building everywhere, right? I mean, the export numbers are up, but that doesn't count what's actually getting sold to the end customer. So you have all this inventory, either hidden or in cases, that causes things that are reactions that are not optimal. So you have basically brands having to buy back stock, maybe destroying stock. You have models flooding the gray market. And in the end, I think while it feels good as a consumer to potentially get these deals, it's a bit like having a meal that's just too big, right? It feels good in the moment and not so much afterwards. So I would say that the quantity of choice of brands is a positive. The quantity of inventory that is associated with all of those brands in the market, particularly the big ones, that's where the problems start. Rob, what do you think?
So it raises a couple of interesting points in my mind. I'll try not to get too tangential with them, but I'll just mention what I'm thinking. When it comes to the creativity or the ability to create that we're seeing from a lot of small, ambitious brands, I would say this, that good ideas don't always make for good business. And it's difficult when you are sitting on the outside of the industry looking at it, saying, okay, I want to enter this industry. What am I going to design? You're right, David. You can choose one of two strategies. What am I going to build? Or who am I going to sell it for? And then the business plan or the product plan follows afterwards. I'm always in favor of what am I going to build, simply because I think it's the more worthwhile approach to take, the more valuable thing for watchmaking as a whole. Although I do concede that it doesn't always result in a product that is commercially viable. Some excellent products we've seen come out of small brands in recent years are priced at a level that make it difficult for them to have success because they're going up against incredibly established brands. We've identified already that since the downturn, the one price point, or the two price points actually, that are doing very well are anything from 500 to 2,000 euros, they're flying off the shelves. And anything above, say, 10,000 euros is flying off the shelf. Everything in between, and that's a huge amount of the industry and really the vast majority of what we talk about on a daily basis, comprising Omegas, Breitlings, Rolexes, some Rolexes at least, Cartiers, these are within that bracket. And if you've got a young brand that's trying to put out a new watch around 5 or 6K, then you better come with a long, long list of funders behind you, because otherwise you're going to be running into a Speedmaster or a Tudor chronograph or a Cartier tank. You know, it's not easy to make hay in that price bracket. And it's made even harder by the fact that big brands, and this goes to your inventory point, David, my second thought on what you said, the big brands are able to basically throw a lot of shit at the wall and see what sticks. They can release references, catalogs with 500 pages, reference lists as long as your arm, and send them out all around the world to their retailers. And if they're big and powerful brands like Omega, for example, they can demand that those retailers take X amount of whatever new stock they're taking if they want to get the preferential models. But then you end up exactly as you described, David, with cases full of stuff that nobody wants to buy. I was curious the other day about Omega's current DeVille selection, if I can call it that. It's I don't know what to say. It's like 10 catalogs long itself. There's over 450 references in the DeVille collection. I don't know the last time I met somebody that bought a modern DeVille. Now, I know that they're popular in the Asian market and pretty much, I reckon, only exist for that reason. And I think that we discussed in the past about possibly the wisdom in brands having region-specific catalogs to maintain a clearer outlook of what it is they offer and who they're offering it to. But that's just crazy. Like, what a list of products to wade through. What an undefined, a fuzzy-edged brand concept that is. I like it when brands have very few references, that they discontinue products when they move on to a new phase of their development, and they focus very much on what it is they're doing now, who they are, and what you can expect from them. And I think these new brands that are coming into the fray, they obviously do that by necessity because they don't have the ability to have 500 products on the catalog at any one time. But how difficult is it going to be for them to rise above the noise and to be heard when there's so much from the big brands just being desperately pushed out there to see what sells? What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, 2 points that you raised there, which I also brought up in my article. And so let's talk about them. So in terms of supply and demand, we've already covered, I think, the supply on the watch side. So now we're talking about demand. Those Constellation models, they're not all for me. And I guess, sorry, DeVille. There's two that I like in particular. There's the Hour Vision, which I think might be discontinued, but I also think is still on the website. And then there's one of the newer ones. It's like a 40mm hand wind with a blue or white linen dial. The name escapes me. I'm sorry. Maybe, you know, either of you two know it, but they're very handsome watches. The trouble is, buying those watches potentially doesn't really square away with the recent article I proposed, which was, you know, trying to pare my watch collection down. I mean, now anytime I think of buying another watch, I'm like, no, I'm happy with what I have now. And what I'm getting at here is that on the demand side, there's really three ways to make more money. If you're a watch company, it's raise the price of watches. I want to talk about that. It's sell more watches to the people who own them, or get more people into the hobby, sell them watches, and then sell them more watches. So go back to point two. On the demand side, I'm very skeptical of the ability of the watch industry to sell more and more watches to the same people. And I say that it's almost like the thing that the watch industry does best, which is not do planned obsolescence, which is make things that really will last a lifetime. So they're quite singular in that respect. Almost catches up to them in this case, because whereas 50 or 60 years ago, you'd sell someone one watch and be done, now the health of the industry basically relies on just selling over and over and over again. In a lot of cases, to the same people. And that's how you end up with these, like you said, Rob, you know, catalogs that are, you know, phone book sized for one specific model line. So that's the first point. The second point is this is happening in conjunction with price increases. Now, this is something that has been talked about in the greater watch press. And I'm not sure if this is, how to put this, like a consequence of what I understand as being a very long decision cycle in the watch industry. So you don't do something unless you've got 2 or 3 years visibility in front of you, or if it's like the last attempt to really squeeze the juice out of this recent upturn, because to have so much inventory potentially coming into the market at a time when people, I suspect, might be buying fewer and fewer watches, and then to increase your prices, like Rolex, I know, is something along the lines of 4%, but I heard Jaeger LeCoultre went up some really quite eyebrow-raising amount for the classic Reverso. Obviously, the Ingenieur came in at five figures. So these price increases are happening at a very inopportune time when all of this demand is coming. And I think Omega just raised their price as well, right? And we have just talked about how much inventory might be coming to the market. So that's really where I see the trouble happening. And I guess, you know, maybe Alon, on the retailer side, you've lived through these. You have to deal with, you know, like Rob said, having to buy models that maybe you don't want to get the good stuff, the price increases, the preferences of your customers. I mean, how are you experiencing this currently, and how have you experienced this in the past?
Currently, became worse of the past. Sounds a bit cryptic. The Pareto rule, which is 20-80, applies also to watch retail, meaning 20% of your collection does 80% of your turnover. Means 80% of the collection that the brands expect you to buy is dead weight. So that has been like this for donkey years. That's the joy of being a CPO dealer. You can buy the heck you want, you can sell the heck you want, and usually you stay in that sweet spot of 20% that has a high rotation. But for us, the fun is to have also the 80%, but you'll see the fact that they're less wanted effectuated in the price. So it's a lot lower price point. So the CPO markets are fair. Now, you made excellent points with your 3 points about how watch brands can make more money. The raising of prices is simply a leverage tool of supply and demand. If there's more demand than supply, what do? You put prices up, right? That's a simple economic rule. Pushing more watches to collectors is a difficult one. And how do you make us idiots, watch idiots, WISs, even more crazy? Either you do that with waiting lists, right? Create fake demand. An interesting case that I wanted to discuss with you, gents, is what did you think of Piaget's orchestrated influencer media bomb for the Polo 79? Was it a success or not?
Jesus, hands are flying up all over the room here. So, David, I'm going to let you take it. I saw you jump in before me, but we obviously have something to say. Go ahead.
You know, it's hard because, Alon, I almost think that you're referring to Hodinkee because they came up a lot. They had done sort of a Piaget buying guide, and then a week later, this new watch was released. And, you know, look, like it's different. I will give it that. Like, that is a watch that doesn't look like anything on the market. And it is of its time in the sense that it looks like a 70s or 80s watch, which means that it is not going to be for everyone. It is in limited quantities and it is expensive. So in that kind of instance, it kind of goes against everything that I've said now. But on the other hand, it doesn't, because it is targeted at a very certain type of buyer. And the type of buyer who will buy that watch will spend 80 grand the way I spend €3 for a coffee. I just don't think it matters. So, you know, I would say that in that respect, I think Piaget is doing exactly what I would do if I were in that position, which is, okay, let's focus on the stuff that we know we can sell in small volumes, build some hype, and then kind of tweak down at our lower end models to make sure we're not flooding the market with those. But I think, I would say that time will tell. We'll see how it does and how it's viewed in 6 months, a year's time, 2 years' time. But I would just say, thinking through it now, it seems to me like Piaget achieved what they wanted to with that model. Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it was a barnstorming success for the reasons that you mentioned. I do believe they got what they wanted. It was, well, let's face it, from a critical perspective, from a product perspective, it's beautiful. It's exceptional. It's a great, mild reimagining of a classic piece. it was desired, but not desired at that price. But the price is so stratospheric, as you say, it will sell. That's the great irony of it all. It's so expensive that it will go to the moneyed few that aren't affected by these ebbs and flows of the industry down in the shallows as we are. And I just think it's a marketing tool, isn't it? You know, it, not just the way that they presented it, but a watch of that nature is not designed to be a mass market product or particularly commercial. Think about what happened to Chapek when they released the Antarctique. All the models they'd been making up until that point, good quality, credible models, just like the rest of the Piaget catalog, were ignored. But suddenly, because they had that icon that was on every front page around the world, they started selling everything they had, everything they could possibly make. And I'm sure Piaget hopes the same thing's going to happen to them.
Quick word on that, because clearly this has gotten some discussion going. I know, Alan, you have something you want to add, but I don't know that, well, I would like for you to, Rob and Alan, to either correct me if I'm wrong and also chime in on this, but about a year ago or 18 months ago, Piaget unveiled, I don't think it was marketed to women, I think it's listed as unisex, but there is a 36 millimeter Polo S that was released, which looked fantastic. But it definitely raised my eyebrows, because when I saw the price, it was on a strap and it was something like 11 or 12,000 euros. And I hope that something like that sells. I really do. So the ideal case for a company like Piaget would be to build the hype with something super expensive, like the watch we just talked about, and then somehow translate that down to sales of something like a 36 millimeter Polo S, which is perfectly suited to today's market and tastes, and be able to kind of leverage that. And again, tweak at the margins, you know, keep your supply in check. But if you could sell from the top down all the way, I think that would be even more proof of the success of a model.
But yeah, that's exactly what we saw Vacheron do with a 222, right? You make something out of precious metal, you make it almost unattainable. Everybody looks at it and they shift out their collection that they couldn't sell before, because there's a ton of patrimony models and métier d'art in the Vacheron line that doesn't get the attention it deserves. But you have that one hook you throw out into the ocean, you can drag in a whole load of fish with that.
Don't agree. I need to go back a few things that you guys said. So we can agree on one thing. They created the hype, because that was what I hoped you guys would say. They hyped it. Going back to the question, how do you sell more watches to these watch nerds, right? Because I didn't even deal with the third part, and that's the most interesting part for a marketeer. How do you get newbies into the watch game? And that is the biggest ocean that you want to fish in, right? Because there you have the most fish and it's the biggest pond. But going back now to this Piaget case. So, David, you said there is nothing like it in the market. There is. It's their own Polo. It's just a re-edition. So, is it a stunning watch? Hell yes, Rob, you're right. Is it boring? Hell yes. Is it a smart move? Maybe. Is it original? Is it creative? No, because you just said they learned from the Vacheron 222. So, but it begs the question, when it came out in 79, and I believe Yves Piaget created it, when he designed it, it was new, it was innovative, it was a cool design. It was mostly for the American market, because Piaget was legendary in the US, and in the US they would rock a lot of gold watches with gold bracelets. And then they were already attacking watch idiots, so they didn't attract a new market. So they're literally recycling that old marketing strategy. And who you think did they attack with this watch? It was all the gold day date wearers in the US that they wanted to switch to a Piaget Polo. Did they succeed? As far as I recollect in my memory, my American family all used to rock gold day dates. Small, big, whatever, men, females, date just in gold, in all sizes. And some of them, indeed, I remember, had this Polo on their wrists. So, question for you guys. Who are they targeting now? Is it, you think, in that new pond, and they're trying to hype it to attract somebody who is willing to spend 80K or something else and will buy a Piaget? Or is it actually those that have a gold Royal Oak, a gold day date, or I don't think a gold Moses Streamliner will switch to a Piaget Polo, but who knows? Who do you think they're targeting?
Oh, I think it, well, to me, it's the latter. And really what I'd like to talk about, Alon, is the $5 or $10 billion question or whatever it is how do you get new people into the market? And there's two ways to do that. You can either do that top down. And I think that's what we've seen over the last several years of the rise of social media. It's, you know, get your watch on the wrist of an athlete or a musician or an actor and hope that people follow suit. But I think that's very fleeting, right? Because if someone's chasing hype, it's like with Supreme in the streetwear market. I don't think anyone's really too concerned with, you know, fabric weight and threads per inch and things like that. They just want Supreme. And then when Supreme isn't cool anymore, they move on. So then the second way to do that is bottom up. And I think that the most, or the closest we've gotten to that is, of course, the moon swatch. So it's going to take years, I think, for that to work its way through the industry in terms of follow-on effects. But it doesn't always work, right? So I don't know if either of you two remember, but Baume & Mercier, like maybe 10 years ago now, had a brand that was called just Baume, B-A-U-M-E, and it was supposed to be targeted at younger consumers to get them interested in watches. And as far as I know, that fell completely flat on its face. But having said that, I think that that is most likely how you're going to get new people in, is not so much from Instagram and hype. It's from the bottom up. So then finally, to bring things back to your question, Alon, about who is this targeted to, you know, I think because this is a Piaget, which is pretty niche, I don't see this, even though it is horologically on par with the VC222 or a gold Royal Oak. I don't think that's what this is. I think this is something that's aimed purely at collectors who know watches. And again, for whom 80 grand is like me, you know, going and buying my baguette, basically.
Well, I think that it's kind of a perfect release, because I think that who are they targeting this at? I'd say the people that have already bought it and the people that will ensure that it sells out, because there's very few of them. What they've done is not attract customers to a particular model within their collection. They've attracted eyes, just people looking at Piaget again. I did it. I went, followed all the links from all the articles about the new model, which I loved, saw the price, and I was like, okay, well, I'm never going to be able to afford that. Maybe, let's say I could afford it, would I buy it? No, I'd buy a Bernerón instead. You know, that's not a watch for me. If I had, like David said, crazy amounts of money where this was just nothing, yeah, I would buy it because it's gorgeous and it's lovely. And I guess if I cared about exclusivity, I could say it's also exclusive. But I think the important thing is I visited their website. I refamiliarized myself with what Piaget are doing right now. Because all I've heard from Piaget in the last 10 years that was article worthy was when they broke another world record in their tussle with Bulgari for like the thinnest movements in XYZ or the thinnest Tourbillon or the thinnest, I don't know what, watch without a main plate, blah, blah, blah. So I think it's done exactly the job. I think it's very rare that a brand is able to do it, because there are very few brands that can command that kind of money for a single piece and sell it out. But that's my perspective.
Yeah, but so to bring it back to kind of the industry-wide perspective is we're now entering new releases season. So fantastic. Like Piaget sold a bunch of these new polos, but they've got a ton of at lower end, and that's a very loose quotation, but lower end watches that they have to sell, and they're going to release more. So it's one thing to sell out your super high-end stuff. You have to be able to then sort of moderate what's going on below that. And I just don't think that the industry is going to get by. They've got to have some way of bridging their super hot horology stuff or their super luxurious stuff with some of the lower end models. And in some cases, they just can't do that because a company like Breitling, for example, I don't think has the jewelry cachet of a Piaget to do that, essentially. So that really, to me, is the link that's missing. And I see you both definitely have some things to say. So what's going through your minds?
I don't think there has to be a direct product link, to be honest. I think that they've achieved their goal with this. They've got people talking about Piaget again. Now, I know when Vacheron did this, I was thinking, okay, well, we're going to see some further iterations of this new 222 concept in steel or titanium that make it affordable. Because once those gold ones are gone, they don't need to bring it back. In fact, they probably can't because of the way that they presented it. So surely they're going to then capitalize on the fact that people are looking at it, desirous of it, couldn't get it, And then, oh, here's another iteration, a different material of the same watch that you all want. They could do the same thing. Piaget could do this model in steel or white gold or platinum and keep selling chunks of that piece while keeping people excited about the brand of Piaget. I'm not sure there needs to be like a halfway house for that brand, because people will see Piaget in maybe not a better light, but certainly a more desirable light because of this model that's sold out. It's a brand building exercise as well as it is like a small commercial move, and I think an excellent marketing strategy.
I agree. And while I've been listening to you guys, I was very curious, and it was almost a rhetorical question, if Hypebeast.com wrote about it. Obviously, they did. Super shallow, half-ass copy-paste press release effort. But I know Hypebeast pays attention to watches. I don't frequent that website. I know it from the sneaker world. That's what I know of it. But while I'm sitting and listening to you guys and looking at their homepage, it dawned on me. How do watch brands find new customers? They need to make sure that in the top frame menu, watches needs to become a category, because the first one is fashion, followed by footwear, art, design, music, lifestyle. And then you get generic topics like brands, their magazine, and the Hypebeast 100. And on their homepage, they have a top 10 ranking of brands going up and down. And do you guys think there's a watch brand in there? Strangely enough, Rolex and AP are not there, or G-Shock for that matter. So if I jump the gun and do already, if I was a CEO of watch brands, that's a thing that I might have considered, being a CEO of a watch brand, to find new customers that are not watchers yet.
But do you not think that this project from Piaget has kind of had the same effect? I don't disagree that that would be a great idea.
Yeah, you're right.
I'm sure it's an expensive thing to buy, but like this watch is, it was influencer driven, and it was, I mean, I don't want to wax lyrical about it too much or pay too much credit to it, because I think it's pretty low hanging through the strategy, but it ticked a lot of boxes. It's horologically credible. It has a legacy within the industry. It's going to sell at that price point, because that's a non-competitive price point in comparison to the lower end that we're talking, like sub 10K. And it's drawn eyes to the company. So yeah, there's more they can do. They can push it further. They could definitely work with something like Hypebeast, but you know, it's done what it set out to do, as far as I can see.
I agree. And I agree what you said. They attracted a lot of eyeballs with just 79 pieces that will give them a guaranteed hit, and they know it will sell out. And you're right. They have kind of created a problem, because they're not going to make this one in steel, or unless it has never been made in steel, if I remember correctly, because David referred to the Polo S. By coincidence, we traded one in recently, a 41, and I believe we're selling it for just 8K. So David, even lower than the 1112 that you were referring at. And that indicates what a fair price is, which is ultra subjective. So I'll give the mic to you, David, and I suggest we wrap it up for today. Awesome session.
Hopefully the bridge that I'm about to make now is a good segue into the next show, which, as I said, will be, you know, what would we do? And it's just that I really hope that for all of the success that Piaget has of this model and other brands have with similar analogs, that they can translate that to selling the other things in their catalog. Because, you know, I'll be frank, like, even if I can't get a steel Polo 79, I won't be sad, because there's still the 36 millimeter Polo S to look at. But that's also a difficult decision to make, because then I have to cross shop with everyone else and all of the other watch models that are out there currently. And I think that is really the to be continued here is how does the industry deal with all of that supply overhang going forward. And with that, Rob, I'll turn it over to you, and look forward to the second part of the discussion.
Well, I think it became apparent by the end of the episode that we had a lot to share on this subject, and it's taken us in many different directions. I hope we didn't move too far away from the original article for our listeners' enjoyment, but we do have part two coming. So I think we're going to try and refocus our attentions on exactly what we think is going to be happening in the future when we get to that. Please do stay tuned to The Real Time Show. Our next episode is episode 150, which is another milestone for the show as we approach 500,000 downloads all time. Thank you very much for supporting us this far. We have some changes upcoming to the publishing schedule and the format of the show, and we would like you all to come along for the ride as we explore this new era of The Real Time Show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so via the usual channels, either our personal Instagram accounts. I'm there at Rob Nudds, R-O-B-N-U-D-D-S. Alon can be found at Alon Ben Jones, A-L-O-N-B-E-N-J-O-S-E-P-H, and David can be found at D-A-V-A-U-C-H-E-R. You can contact us via our website, via the contact form, that's www.therealtime.show, or via our dedicated Instagram handle at therealtime.show. If you have a longer format or a more personal email you'd like to send us, you can contact either Alon or I via our email addresses, Rob or Alon at therealtime.show. Until next time, stay safe and keep on ticking.